Now, I apologize for the first session. There was a distraction, you might call it, from our ongoing study, but I felt it was necessary to bring this to your attention. Certainly, you do understand that it makes no difference to me what the government does. We simply observe. But I am trying to give you wisdom in the evaluation of the events of our day so that you don't overreact and understand that in a mature client nation, we as a people should be able to come together, make hard choices, as so many of the politicians talk about, in order to restore order in the nation. These things are well and good. They may be needful, and they may be useful, but they will fail if you do not do your duty here in the continued pursuit of truth and your advance toward the high ground of spiritual maturity. If those who gather here perform their duties with regard to the spiritual life of the church age, then Jesus Christ will control history on our behalf and on behalf of the others who are doing the very same thing in doctrinal churches across this land. Now, we have noted a number of things in our study in the first session. They centered on the concepts of our nation and how it might manage terrorist assaults on the country, the need for G2 agents, the need for black operatives that no one knows where they are, what they're doing, or what their assignments are, the concept of special forces, and the idea of being prepared in these areas before the events occur. And one of the ways that the preparation can go along unabated is if the branches of the government are cooperative in providing our intelligence gathering agencies the latitude that they need to identify the enemy and to bring them to justice. Now, we examined those things from the standpoint of our present current event, and now we want to reflect back into our passage of Genesis 14, resuming our study at point 24. Abram's G2 was designed to feed him information about his nephew's welfare. It was not sophisticated enough to predict, however, the Jordan Valley campaign. And, of course, he may have been brought before a committee and asked, what did he know and when did he know it? And were there any memos that may have tipped him off that Kedarli Omer was coming down the King's Highway and he had in his sights the Pentapolis? Could there have been anything to alert the population down there about what was going on? Well, of course not. This one man did a great job identifying what was going on in the battle and reporting back the fact that Lot had been captured as a hostage. 25. However, knowing of the potentiality of threats from predator powers, Abram had the wisdom to prepare for such an attack. Thus, he had entered into a treaty with his neighbors in the area of Hebron. Abraham was involved in a treaty with these fellows. I want to flip back, if I can, and read to you verse 13 again. Then a fugitive, that's Abram's G2 operative, came and told Abram the Hebrew, the one who crossed over the river. Now he was living in the Oaks of Mamre, that's his geographic location, his headquarters. And Mamre was an Amorite, and he had a brother Eshcol and a brother Aner, and all four were allies, which means that they had gone into a treaty together. They were signatories for their own protection. 26. These neighbors were three Amorite brothers, again, Mamre, Eshcol, and Aner. The Amorites were descendants of Canaan, and Canaan is the fourth son of Ham. Consequently, Abram's neighbors were Hamitics. We studied that when we learned when the second generation went into the land, that when they did so, those that they were to rid from the land were Hamitic first cousins, seven or eight tribes of these Hamitic first cousins. They were not Semitics, and these are not Semitics here. These are Hamitics. Who was in the land before Abram got there? Hamitics primarily. And where were the Semitics? They were in the Mesopotamian River Valley. And therefore, when Abram and Lot came over there, they were visiting, immigrants who had come in to Canaan, which was populated by Hamitics. And why am I telling you this? There were no Palestinians there. That's what. But that's another story that we've already studied. But this is another amplification of that fact. Now, Abraham did not enter into a treaty with the Semites of Mesopotamia. This is his homeland. He didn't go over there and cut a deal with Chedorlaomer or the other kings of the area. He did not pay them tribute, which those who populated the Pentapolis were doing, and apparently those throughout the Jordan Valley were doing. And I explained to you why. That this king's highway was a major trade route of the day. Archaeological evidence shows evidence that that trade route existed before 2000 B.C. And so this is a major highway. This is like Interstate 64. This is big time. This is the way you get goods and services from Mesopotamia all the way to Egypt and from Egypt back to Mesopotamia. And those who control that river valley and that highway are going to keep their economies going because there's a free flow of goods. And these people that lived there had to be kept under control so that they wouldn't get cocky and think they could run the show, which these homosexuals down at the Pentapolis apparently thought they could do, and they challenged Chedorlaomer by withholding tribute in the 13th year. And what did Chedorlaomer do about that? He had a treaty set up with the two other kings in Mesopotamia, as well as the guy from Turkey, and they got together an allied army, and here they come. Now, did Abram cut a deal with these guys? No. He did not have a deal with his countrymen. He may have even known Chedorlaomer. That is where Abram was from, that area. He could well have known the king of Elam. But he didn't do it. Why? His treaty primarily was with Yahweh Elohim. And wisdom led him to form an allied force, actually a rapid deployment force, with these Hamitic brothers. So wisely, he formed a confederation with his neighbors in Hebron, where the Lord had directed him to establish his headquarters. He depended on the Lord. And therefore, there's an application of doctrine here that is strengthened by Abram's wisdom. Doctrine is fine. That is what we recommend for all who have been saved. The spiritual advance is an imperative and it is a necessity. It is the sine qua non for the Christian way of life. But if along the way you do not acquire wisdom with regard to the application of that doctrine, then you're going to make bad decisions along the way. You will be distracted and maybe even frustrated from the advance. Once you get the information, there has to accrue within your soul the wisdom of how to use it, when to use it, how to read historical trends, how to evaluate them, and then determine what to do about them. Abram was wise. Point 28. This confederation agreed to form a rapid deployment force to use whenever their property, possessions, or people came under attack. They agreed to this. We've already studied the word for allies over there. This means that they voluntarily joined in an agreement where all had responsibility to perform certain duties under certain circumstances. So this was in effect a treaty, and it formed a confederacy among these fellows, these four men. 29. Since Abram's nephew was a victim of Chedorlaomer's invasion of the Valley of Siddim, Abram imposed the provisions of the treaty with his neighbors. And these men are referred to again as allies in verse 13. Now 30, let's note the word. B-E-R-I-T, pronounced Brit. You go back to the original meaning, it means to cut off. And then, of course, through change over the years, it evolved into a concept of an obligation. It was the fact that you submit to a certain set of standards or you commit yourself to certain obligations. And Brit is the word here. The word is Brit, refers to self-imposed obligation. The concept evolved into the assumption of mutual obligations on the part of two or more partners. Therefore, we have here a reciprocal Brit. There's reciprocity here. For example, if something happens to Mamre, there's criminal activity, rustlers come in, that means that there is an obligation, a reciprocal obligation on the part of the other three to assist him in tracking down the rustlers and getting his animals back. That's the idea of this, and that's what Brit means. And they've entered into this. It refers to the reaching of a settlement or the establishment of an obligation. 31. Abram and his three neighbors were thus in mutual agreement to defend themselves against outside aggression. They formed an army of four divisions of 300 plus special forces personnel each. Therefore, they are going to have a rapid deployment force, they do, of well over 1,000 men. In verse 14, Abram mobilizes these units into a rapid deployment force. Genesis 14, verse 14. And when Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he led out his trained men, born in his house, 318, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. Point one. The words led out give us insight to Abram's military preparedness, his views on homeland security, and on foreign policy. The word for led out is rock. That's R-A-Q. Rock. It means to empty a vessel. It came to mean the drawing of the sword. When you pull the sword, the scabbard is empty. You have emptied that vessel. And so it becomes an idiom for mustering of troops. He called them out. To muster or mobilize troops, they must already have been systematically trained and equipped for combat. You don't call people out who are not already trained, who are not already armed, who are not already prepared. He thought through this long before Kedarli Omer came into the valley. Have we been doing this? I submit to you over 25 years we have not. And we're paying the piper today, and we better get back to business. And it may cost you some of your freedoms along the way. I don't know. So what if you do? What are you going to do? You're going to call your congressman? Or are you going to orient and adjust? We'll see. I mean, I'm not. Do what you want to do. I'm trying my best to put the present circumstance in a context of logic, clear thinking, common sense, and comparing it to biblical events that have happened in the past. We haven't even thought to study Hushai yet. We've done it before. He would be a good guy. I may have to do this. This may last until, what, Labor Day? Hushai would fit right into this study, wouldn't he? Well, I'll be a dog. We'll just have to pull those notes out and rework that. The mustering of the troops is what is implied here when it says, and when Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, that seized violently, he led out, he mustered his troops. And they have been systematically trained and equipped for combat. Now this is confirmed by the Hapax Legomenon trained men, Shenik. C-H-A-N-I-K, Shenik. Trained men is the way it's translated, and that's fine, point three. The number of trained men was 318 servants who were born in Abram's house. Now, this amounts to a small division who were apparently trained by Abram and put on alert as an instant reaction force prepared to defend Abram's holdings or that of the three signatories to the treaty. He had his men ready to go. Whoever needs them, he can call them out immediately. They're an instant reaction force. There's no training necessary. He's already done that. No going to the armory. They're already armed. We could get into a study of First Amendment rights here, but we won't do that. Point four. There are also implications that can be drawn from these numbers. I quote to you H.C. Loophole's Exposition of Genesis, Volume 1, page 458. We are amazed at the number of the servants. That's 318. That's not all who served Abraham. Those are the ones that were trained to do battle. And then Leupold points out that this points to a body of servants easily numbering 1,000 and gives us some idea of the size of the flocks as well as the influence of the man Abram. Well, you can go to Genesis 13:2, and you can read for yourself that when he came back from Egypt, he had a great deal of livestock, huge herds of livestock, and he had a great deal of silver and gold. And therefore, he could afford a great big staff for his ranch. 5. And so these men were prepared to do battle. When Abram got his G2 report from his intelligence operative, he didn't have to call a meeting with Mamre, Eshcol, and Aner to decide what to do. That is what we've done. We're calling meetings to decide what to do about homeland security and what have you. Well, the men didn't have to negotiate to agree on a coalition either. The coalition was already set ahead of time. That's what we should do as a nation. We should have a coalition already organized and in place, ready to fight terrorism wherever it occurs. And everybody's in agreement about what we're going to do. And those who are not in agreement are against us, as you recall, under the Bush Doctrine. Let's get it done and let's keep it in place and let terrorism be advised. But we always wait till after the fact. We can't do anything before the fact. They didn't have to decide to what degree they would participate in a peacekeeping force. What if we were to defeat Kedorlaomer? Are we going to send a peacekeeping force into Mesopotamia? They didn't discuss that. There was no debate about how many troops each man would provide and whether or not they would be involved in hostile actions or police actions. There was no debate about what provoked Kedorlaomer's attack on the Pentapolis. 6. No such silliness as this was necessary. The four men had already entered into an alliance that stipulated that they would collectively defend each other's interests. The treaty obviously included a paragraph that activated participation by the signatories in the event anyone's relatives or servants were abducted. That activated the treaty. And on this case, it obviously did. 7. Now, you will remember that the word translated allies, Brit, refers to a self-imposed obligation. The coalition had already been formed, and the men had already been trained. They were an instant reaction force that was prepared to be called up for duty whenever a situation demanded it. Therefore, once Abram understood Lot's situation, he was able to instantly call the coalition's forces into action. This is taking place circa 2000. B.C. Abram had this kind of wisdom 2000 B.C. We ain't got this. That's Southern for we don't have this. And I don't know why we don't have it, because we are constantly finding ourselves in these kinds of tight spots. And we get in a tight spot, and everybody wrings their hand and wants to investigate why it happened. What difference does it make why it happened? I think the next obligation ought to be, let's go get the guys who did it, and then let's organize ourselves so we can better defend ourselves in the future. Why do we constantly have to go back and dig up old bones? Why do we constantly have to find some kind of target for our animosities and to blame, and hang him in the public square, and then once that's done, we feel better about ourselves while the terrorists continue to plot? We are a foolish people, and we're not demonstrating that we have wisdom, which is required of a client nation. Client nations a client nation is an enclave for believers to advance once they're saved to the high ground of spiritual maturity and to seek to evangelize others into the plan of God. The Christian population of a client nation doesn't seek to run that nation. But it is also implied that in a client nation that there is a larger population of believers than in, say, a heathen nation or a never-to-be-developed country. As a result, those who have doctrine have influence. They influence people in their own family, their neighborhood, their community, their state, even the nation. Jesus Christ controls history on their behalf. And when a nation is run by free people, that means you get to go vote. How do you vote? Do you vote based on how the candidate stacks up against your biblical wisdom? That would be a way that you would be influencing the government, how you vote, how you influence others, how you raise your children, how they think once they reach adulthood, and then how they will then decide when they move into the community. So there is invisible impact throughout the culture in a client nation. And when there's a high inventory of people who are making decisions based on biblical wisdom, then that influence says to those who run the country, we're going to respond to what the people want, and we're going to take care of details in a very orthodox and professional way. And what does all that boil down to? It ultimately boils down to the fact that you're going to elect people with at least establishment viewpoint and or biblical wisdom. And the country will be run accordingly. And I'm not making this up. The nation was founded by men who had this kind of ability to think, the wisdom to make decisions that were for the betterment of the entire population. And they even incorporated many of these concepts into our founding documents. As we lose the thought, we lose contact with biblical wisdom as well as establishment concepts. And it is being reflected, and we're making poor decisions, and we are therefore putting our people at jeopardy. Abram had wisdom. Abram had these concepts from his level of spiritual growth in a dispensation called the Gentiles. This is the dispensation of the Gentiles. We don't have the law yet. That's the dispensation of Israel. That comes at the Exodus. What is the biblical revelation? It is however God chooses to reveal information to individuals at that time, and He revealed a lot to Abram. And Abram had faith rest. He did what God told him to do on faith rest. He centered himself in Canaan under faith rest, and he remained there under faith rest. And I submit to you, as we will study later on, that he prepared himself to defend against the exigencies of cosmos diabolicus under faith rest. This is wisdom. Abram had it in 2000 B.C. And in client nation America, we are lacking in biblical wisdom among those who make the decisions that have to do with our security and with our future. So we have this word, Brit, a self-imposed obligation, and he has taken care to make sure that this is all in order. We know that the three brothers have also provided their trained men to the coalition force. From the statement that concludes the description of the battle between Abram's Delta force and the Mesopotamian Allied army, the war is over in this passage, but it provides us information about the strength of the Delta force. Genesis 14, verse 24. I will take nothing, says Abraham, except what the young men have eaten. In other words, after the battle of Dan, which is going to come up, there's a place in Gilead named Dan. Dan Jaim. That is the bivouac of Kedorlaomer Omer in the Mesopotamian army. And they know they've cleaned out this entire highway here. There's nobody to the north that they haven't defeated. There's no one to the south they haven't defeated. And they're in this Jordan Valley, and they're headed north back home. Somewhere along in here, they leave the battlefield, and then they head north. And somewhere along in here is where they bivouac for the night. And here comes Abram with his Delta force. We'll get to the battle later on. But when the battle is over, There's booty. Booty. These people down here, Ken Arley Oma's army, have got booty from the inhabitants of the Pentapolis. So they have what belongs to these guys as well as their own possessions. So there's possessions, booty, from the army, and then there's booty. The booty of the booty. There's plenty of booty to go around. A lot of you don't seem to know what booty. You've been listening to rap music too much. This is a legitimate word, and you can find it in your dictionary. And I will not apologize for it. Booty is where you take possessions from somebody that's dead on a battlefield. And you didn't know that, did you? You bunch of perverts. So I say again, all this booty was available. And what did Abram say? He's a man of integrity. Look at verse 24. His soldiers are there, about 1,200 strong, just victorious. And all this booty is lying around. I will take nothing except what the young men have eaten, and the share of the men who went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, let them take their share of the food. They didn't take the stuff except what belonged to Lot. Lot got his stuff back. Point 9. These four divisions formed a rapid deployment force organized by Abram and motivated by wisdom. There you go. Four divisions formed a rapid deployment force. It was organized by Abram and motivated by wisdom. Abram had confidence. He was in the geographical will of God when he settled on the high ground at Hebron. Let's take a look at that. Genesis 13:17. Arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you, Abram. Verse 18, and Abram moved his tent and came and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre, which are in Hebron. And there he built an altar to the Lord. Well, let's get us a map here. What was it the Lord promised him? Not in this context, but in the several proclamations of what's known as the Palestinian covenant, the real estate that was given and promised to Abraham. Here is the Nile River. I'll put my finger there. Boy, that's pretty fuzzy. The Nile River here, the Euphrates River here. Up here is what we call Turkey. So you have Turkey, and then this is the Persian Gulf, and this is the Red Sea, and they all plug into the Indian Ocean somehow. So what is this piece of real estate promised to Abraham? Promise is still in effect, by the way. Everything from Turkey to the Indian Ocean, between the Nile and Euphrates rivers, that's Israel. And the boys that are over here were Hamitics originally. And the Lord told Joshua, go get them, flush them out, don't leave anything alive, don't even leave fruit-bearing trees. We've been through that. So under divine mandate, the Jews possess this little piece of land right here, right now, where you see Jerusalem. And in the millennial kingdom, they will get this entire plot of ground. And that will be client nation Israel, the permanent client nation Israel. Now, this is what Abram was told. And he says, now you're in Canaan. And here's what I want you to do. I want you to just walk around Canaan, because this is your base of operations. You can see Canaan on this map. Yep, it says it right there. And Hebron, that says Mamre right here, and Hebron right by it. They were next to each other. Mamre is, of course, what in downtown Hebron. And this is the high ground. You can see the mountain range going through here. This is the high ground. And Abram was told, go walk around this place. This is your base of operations. And then eventually I will show you where to settle, and that was at Hebron, high ground. So So verse 18 has four calimperfect verbs that come into view. The first three indicate a change of location for Abram after having taken a walk around the land. So where was he? Well, he went to Bethel. Let's see if I can, my eyes can see these little names here. Bethel is on here somewhere, and I just can't see it. It may not even be here. But it's in this neck of the woods. And that was his base of operations after coming back from Egypt. And then the Lord said, okay, I'm reiterating the Palestinian covenant to you. Move around the land and then decide where you want to settle with your headquarters. So we see three verbs here, all imperfect, moved, came, and dwelt. He moved, he came, he dwelt. The three linked together, all calimperfects are important. Point 11. When Abram entered Canaan, he set up his tent on a mountain near Bethel. That's found in Genesis 12, verse 8. Following a famine temporarily to Egypt, Abram returned to Bethel, as is noted in Genesis 13, verse 3. 12. It is at Bethel that the Lord repeats to him the Abrahamic and Palestinian covenants and invites him to take a walk around the land, as we noted in Genesis 13, verse 17. Point 13. After having taken this tour, Abram made the decision to move his headquarters from Bethel to Hebron. And thus we have the three verbs, moved, came, and dwelt. Together, they tell us that Abram settled in Hebron, which is on the high ground. He took a look at the country, and what did he decide to do? There were two things he needed to do. A place to set up his business. He was a herdsman. And he needed a place where there was good availability of crops and what have you, where he could graze his animals, as well as defend his possessions. And that's the high ground. And he looked around, and Hebron is what caught his eye. And he settled by a grove of oaks near Mamre and his two brothers. 14. This was a strategic move with regard to the best location for him to establish his herds, which are noted in Genesis 13:2, and to defend them from aggressors, which we're observing now. 15. At the time, Lot had not made the decision to move to Sodom. Therefore, the development of a coalition among Abram and the three Hamite brothers, who also lived in the area, was motivated by the desire to protect their holdings from rustlers or from armies. But Lot is not the motivation for this. This occurred, the treaty occurred before Lot left for Sodom. 16. This then is an expression of wisdom. Abram, by faith, had come to Canaan. He was directed by the Lord not only to that area, but specifically to Hebron. 17. Without wisdom, Abram could well have decided that since the Lord took him to Hebron, that he was safe there until the Lord's protection, that he was safe there under the Lord's protection without need of military preparedness. That would not be wise. Now, we're at a place where we may stop. Here's the deal. We've got Abram not only in Canaan, but headquartered at Hebron. This is a key geographic location for defensive purposes as well as economic reasons. Abram could have said, I am in the geographic will of God. I will be protected by Him. I therefore have no fear of predator nations, invading armies, criminals, rustlers, or the type. Therefore, I'll just go about my business up here without any fear whatsoever that those who are motivated in cosmos diabolicus might turn their eyes over here. I know the Lord will take care of me. We will find out that that would not be wise. We instead will find out that Abram is very wise. But our challenge will be to determine why that is, and thus why what he does in Genesis 14 gives us clues about the responsibilities of a client nation toward its people and the responsibilities it has for their security. And we will resume our study on Tuesday evening. Heavenly Father, we are grateful to you for the power of the Word, the opportunity to study it, the privilege of spiritual growth, and the prospect of serving you efficiently in Cosmos Diabolicus. May we be motivated by reciprocity toward you and your magnificent grace as we continue our pursuit of truth. And we lift our prayer in the name of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, who is Yahweh Sabaoth, the Lord of the armies. Charis human kai rene, plethuntae en epinosai, tu theu kai iesu, tu kuriu hemon. And now may grace and prosperity be multiplied unto you by means of your knowledge of God and of Jesus our Lord. Amen.